a few moments ago. I guess you're going to show your age if you remember this, or perhaps you're some of those, and there's one or two here whose parents remember it and have got the videos. But I wonder if any of you remember watching the A-Team on TV. Does anybody remember the A-Team? And they would go through all sorts of rescue or building of weird gadgets, and they always seemed to have an oxyacetylene blowtorch in whatever situation they found themselves, able to melt things together and so on. And at the end of the rescue, or at the end of whatever had happened, Hannibal, who was the leader of the A-Team, some of the younger folk here that are smiling. Has it been on TV recently? I don't know. Has it? All right. Hannibal, at the end of the rescue, the team leader, would always say with a big grin on his face, "I love it when a plan comes together." Don't you just love it when a plan comes together? Isn't that a nice thing to be able to say? So you're planning for something important, and you put all the things in place for it to work, don't you? And you make sure that everybody's going to be in the right place at the right time, that your right financial arrangements have been made, and that all the systems are organized, and the invitations are ordered, or the suit, I'm thinking of a wedding, or something like that. Whatever it is that it is you're trying to organize, be it on a small scale, a simple kids' party, right through to something, a big project in work, or maybe something as enormous as a family wedding, anything at all. When the plan all comes together, there is a huge sense of relief, isn't there? When it's worked and everything, all the boxes can be ticked and everybody can say, at last, thank goodness. The planners of the 200th Trafalgar celebrations must have felt just that on Friday, where the Queen walked up to light the beacon, and as she put the flame in, finally the thing erupted. What would they have done if the flame didn't light? I always feel that sense of relief at the beginning of an Olympics, where the guy walks in and, you know, fires the arrow as they did in Athens, or puts the torch down and woof. What would they do if it didn't catch fire? How many times have they really practiced lighting that Olympic flame? We feel that great sense of relief for the same reason as I was sharing with the children. Parents couldn't keep their promises always. That however much we plan and check, and however sure we are that we've got it all sorted out, we all know, don't we, that there is always a faint possibility that our planning will fail, and that the ridiculous and unexpected will take place, and that we cannot do what we said we were going to do. People let you down, unavoidably sometimes, and so it goes on. How can it be that a sense of relief is never to be felt? How can you possibly live life with the certainty of knowing that the plans that you're relying on will always work? Back here in Genesis chapter 46, the planning is over. We saw it, those that were here last week, in chapter 45. Don't read it now, but if you weren't here last week, do have a look at chapter 45, and you'll see there that all the plans apparently have come together. It's all worked out just right. And that because the planning is over and the promises are fulfilled. And Israel, whose name means he wrestles with God, Israel finally is on his way to see his long-lost son Joseph. Everything is sorted out. The promises have been fulfilled. And when Joseph first had the dreams back in chapter 37 of Genesis, that some way, somehow, all his family was going to bow down and worship him. And all his brothers were offended, and so offended were they that they sent him into slavery. Remember, maybe you just have to look back at Genesis chapter 37 and see the response of different members of the family there. As you look back at chapter 37 and he tells his father and the rest of them the dreams that he'd had, that one day, someday, the whole family was going to bow down to him and honor him. His brothers, verse 11 of chapter 37, were told, his brothers were jealous of him, but his father, it says, kept the matter in mind. Here we are in chapter 46 of Genesis, and Dad has been thinking for the last 20 years and more that Joseph is dead.
But somewhere tucked in the back of his mind is God's promise to Joseph. Jacob knows very well, after the incident of Jacob's ladder, that God sometimes, particularly in these days, sometimes at that point, revealed himself and what he was going to do through dreams. So Jacob had had a dream and had seen it fulfilled. So Joseph had a dream and had seen it fulfilled. And these people knew very well that God always keeps his promises. They'd seen it in their own lives. They'd seen it most notably in the promise given to Abraham way back in chapter 12, where Abraham, as he was then called, had been told by God, who was fulfilling out his rescue plan for the world, "Abraham," he said, "leave your country, your people and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." These people, this family, knew very well that when God promises something like that, that the whole world would be blessed through them, some way, somehow, he was going to keep that promise. So here is Israel, with all of this going on in his mind, all his family before him, and he's on his way to see the long-lost son he hasn't seen for 20 years and thought was dead. And on his way, he stops. And he's come back, and if you like, this is the first point. I think this passage has got one great title over the top of it, of Lord's faithfulness, but I've split it into two just so that we can follow our thinking here. It is point one, that he's come back to this place on his way to see Joseph of Beersheba. He's come back to prove God's faithfulness. Just read verses 1 to 4 with me, and you'll see what I mean. So Israel, again, notice that Jacob is called Israel there. He wrestles with God. That's what it means. So he wrestles with God, set out with all that was his. And when he reached Beersheba, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in a vision at night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." "Here I am," he replied. "I am the God of your father," he said. "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again, and Joseph's own hand will close your eyes." Were you somebody that was beginning to read the book of Genesis here at chapter 46? Then the fact that he stopped at Beersheba to offer sacrifices to God makes him no more than just a religious bloke. He could have stopped anywhere to offer sacrifices to God, I suppose you could argue. But there's something quite specific here about the fact that he stopped here at Beersheba. For Joseph and his family, this isn't just another event on the way. For Jacob and his family, this isn't just another event on the way to see Joseph. If you take the time to stop and see what's going on, there's something really quite startling about, just here in verse 1, in fact, about the very fact that he stopped where he stopped. Beersheba at this point was a very remote little place, in fact. It's just a tiny little well, that's all there was. A little spot slap bang in the middle of the widest part of the land of Israel. I don't know what your geography of the land of Israel is like, even in these days, but if you regard Israel, people often say if that's the Mediterranean, people often say that the Mediterranean comes down here and Israel is kind of shaped like that. Well, that's actually not true. Israel is shaped more kind of, particularly in these days, like that. And there's a long triangle bit that comes up there. And Beersheba is right in the midpoint between the two widest bits of the triangle. If you wanted to find the geographical center of Israel, Beersheba would be it. In other words, you could look north and south and east and west from Beersheba, and you would be able to see, in theory, the whole land. I don't know how high it is. Bits of it are high, bits of it aren't. A bit like if you wanted to find the geographical center of the United Kingdom. Is it the United Kingdom? Maybe it's just of England. Then it would be, the name has escaped me. Can somebody tell me? Up in the Midlands, near Nottingham. Ashby de la Zouche is right in the middle, is right slap bang in the middle of England, I think, maybe of the United Kingdom. You can't get further from the sea than in Ashby de la Zouche, which is why the famous song goes, "Ashby de la Zouche by the sea." I know not why, that's just how it goes. But there's Beersheba, right in the middle. at the very center of the whole country, in other words. In fact, these days it's the fifth largest city of Israel with a population of nearly 200,000. But its background starts back in Genesis. In fact, back in Genesis chapter 21. And there it was that Abraham, as he was then, established a treaty over water rights with a local Philistine warlord. Turn back to just Genesis 21 for a second, and you'll see why it's called Beersheba. Genesis 21 and verse 31. Page 30, I guess it is, or something like that. And you see that the place, therefore, verse 31, having established this treaty, we read, so that place was called Beersheba, because the two men swore an oath there. Beersheba literally means well of oath. It could mean well of seven, but much better to understand it as well of oath. In other words, it's a bit like we might name a place the Promise Wood or something like that. They dug a well there. They'd agreed the water rights. And this is the place that from here on in is going to be called the Well of Oath, the Well of Promise, so that everyone may remember what it's called or why it's there. And it's a significant name, not because of the agreement made there between this local warlord and Abraham and all of his descendants. That's not the particular significance. But because it was at that point that Abraham began to see the promise of God that he would bless him and curse those who cursed him and help those who help him and so on, all starting to be worked out. Here's a local Philistine warlord, and it looks as though Abraham is going to go to war with the local inhabitants, and he doesn't. And indeed, not only does he not go to war with the local inhabitants, something quite amazing happens. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba, and there, we're told, he called upon the name of the Lord, the Eternal God. In other words, I've made a great agreement with the local inhabitants here, and God is faithful. God's keeping his promise to me. Run forward some years, and you'll find Isaac, Abraham's miracle son, now with a family, and again, remarkably, involved in a quarrel over water rights. You'd think, wouldn't you, that having called the place Beersheba, nobody would have any problem with the fact that the agreement was made there. But by the time we get to Genesis 26, there was a problem. Turn forwards again, just to, if you're still in 21, to 26, and you see there, verse 23 of chapter 26, that having had this long-standing argument in the earlier part of chapter 26, again with a local inhabitant's warlord over who's got the right to the water, he goes up to Beersheba. And with all the trouble in this land, promised by God, with all the trouble, there he is in this land that has been promised by God to him and his family. Verse 24 reads, that night the Lord appeared to him and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid of the local warlord, in other words, and of the hassle over water rights, and of everything that seems to be going wrong in your life. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you, and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. And Isaac built an altar there and called the name of the Lord. And then he pitched his tent, and his servants dug a well. And you find later on, if you read on, that they found water in that well as well. In other words, here is Isaac at the very central point of the country, and in response to all the hassle he's enduring, the Lord promises Isaac, I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid. I'll bless you and increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. And Isaac continued to use Beersheba as a base for a very long time. And in fact, it was from there, at that base, that Jacob ran away from Isaac. And everything in the family started to go wrong. And here is Isaac when watching his son Esau, who's a really nasty piece of work, fall out with his son Jacob, who is equally, I think, a nasty piece of work in a different way. And somehow the promises of God are being worked out in this place, Beersheba, where God has promised, I will bless you. So here he is once more, chapter 46 of Genesis, towards the end of his life. And it's here he is at the well of oath that the Lord protected Abraham and made that vital promise to Isaac and to his then two sons,
I will make you into a great nation. It cannot have seemed very lightly for Isaac as he looked about himself that day at the well of oath, that between the nasty, grumpy, horrible Esau and the nasty, scheming, lying, cheating Jacob, that God was going to be able to make them into a great nation. It did not look like that. And 100 years later, which is what a roundabout it must be, Jacob is back there in chapter 46. And the whole family now consists not just of Isaac and Rebekah and their two boys and their servants. God had promised a large family, and Israel stops at Beersheba to offer sacrifices on the altar that his dad had made. And how many does it tell us there are? There are 66 people now in this family. It may not seem after 100 years like pretty good game, but come on. They started with two very unlikely characters, and God had said, I will do this. Here is Jacob, and he's seeing God do it. The point is this, that these chapters are designed to tell us very little about how to survive in a Middle Eastern climate. And these chapters are designed to tell us practically nothing about how to survive a famine. Actually, if you wanted to take this on its rawest, and the way to survive a famine is to get one of your kids, sell them into slavery, and hope that they make prime minister in a country that's got food, and they organize the food so that in 20 or 30 years from now, you've got it right. It's not exactly a handbook to survival, is it? So why is this here? This is not designed so that we put ourselves in the place. This is designed so that we can see what kind of God God is and what He is like and how He works and how He will take the whole of time and the whole of life and the whole of a civilization and orientate things in His sovereign will in such a way that you can look back and say, wow, each one of the people here has free will and how they're operating, and yet in a way we cannot conceive of, that free will is somehow matched up with the sovereignty of God. And He keeps His promises. We've seen time and again, as we've been through this book of Genesis, we saw it clearly pointed out for us in the life of Joseph, and now much more clearly here in Beersheba, more explicitly, that what God said, He did. And goes on doing. We may object and say, but hang on. The sovereignty of God surely doesn't work like that. How can he possibly orientate things around in that way? How can you possibly reconcile that on the one hand these people have all this free will, apparently, and on the other hand, God says He'll keep His promises and is sovereign? To which I guess the Bible's reply is yes. How can you resolve that these two things happen? The answer is that God is sovereign. And you may say, I can't get my mind around that. To which my reply is, fine. There's plenty of things you can't get your mind around, and they're still true. I'm a physicist. I can tell you what gravity does. I can tell you how it works. But I can't describe it more than what it is, other than the fact that it is. And the universe is infinite, apparently. And if it isn't infinite, what's it contained in? And if that isn't infinite, what's that contained? I can't get my mind around that. My brain's not big enough. And with due respect to all of you, neither is yours. But it's still true, isn't it? There's plenty that we resolve as realities that we cannot conceive of. So here is the sovereign God who has taken that which apparently seemed very unlikely and has kept His promise. Because God always keeps His promise. We must have clear in our minds what God is like. That's the purpose of this. He doesn't need to say that He loves it when a plan comes together. As Jacob goes to see Joseph, and as Joseph manages to bless and provide food for his family and the families of the whole world, God doesn't mop His brow and say, phew, so glad that Joseph managed to get all that together, because otherwise I didn't know what I was going to do with all this famine around. God doesn't do that. He always does what He says.
And you and I may face uncertainty in our lives, but here is one thing removed, that if we're relying on what God says, then we will always prove him to be true. And we must not assume that in doing what God says, and this is an important rider, we must not assume, however, that in doing what God says will lead to an easy life. That is not true. So when it came to Joseph in the last 20 years of having the most terrible things happen to him, including being a servant in a prison and lied about and incriminated and so on and so forth, Joseph proved that it doesn't make an easy life, it just makes one that God is in charge of and will fulfill his promises. Nobody did what God the Father said so carefully and so precisely and so exactly as Jesus did. What was the result for Jesus? God kept his promises to have him nailed to a cross. To bear your sin and mine. And to raise him again from the dead. Doing what God said doesn't always lead to comfort, but it does always lead to certainty and assurance and reliability that he will do it no matter what. So if you're a Christian this morning, you too, like these people bearing the promises of God through the centuries, you too are a promise bearer. Jesus said, I will never leave you nor forsake you if you're a Christian. You can rely on that. Jesus said, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. You can live with that certainty if you're a Christian. Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow's got enough worries of its own. How many of us find that difficult to put into practice? But we can live with that certainty because we know that God always does what he says he will do. And when the Lord appears to Israel at Beersheba, it's to give him assurance in chapter 46 of Genesis of the next step in this process. He says, verse 3, I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you. I will surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes. And then Jacob left Beersheba, and Israel's sons took their father Jacob and their children and their wives in the carts Pharaoh had sent to transport him. Do you take much notice of the ads on TV or the blurb that comes through your letterbox? Particularly if you get that investment blurb or those investment ads, and they say, if you invest £10,000 or whatever other ridiculous sum it is now, then you can expect so many percentage growth figures, and in 10 years' time, you will be able to buy a new car, retire, or buy a house, or whatever it is. Have you ever seen that rider? They put that terribly important rider always at the bottom, don't they, that says, past performance is no guarantee of future investment. In other words, we reckon this is going to happen, but don't hold us to it. There's never that rider with God. The very fact that this is here, he said that we can see what God has done in the past and know that that is how he will behave in the future. In fact, the opposite is true. Look as you read the list of Jacob's children and grandchildren, which is why it's all there. Just how well God has proved his point. All the sons, all the little ones that are detailed there, all the grandsons and the Roshis and the Muppin and the Huppim and all the other strange names that there are to our ears. It means that we can be sure that the promises God makes are the promises God keeps. And that he is a God, in fact, who, this is the second point, more than keeps his promises. I'm not going to go through in detail all those names there. It would, I suppose, serve quite useful if we looked at each one of the names and see how God fulfilled his plan and promise and purpose for each one of those lives. We could do that, but we'd spend the next year looking at chapter 46, and we've got other chapters to look at for the moment. Now, Jacob sent ahead of him, therefore, verse 28, Judah, to get directions to Goshen. When they arrived in the region of Goshen, well, you see what else happened from there. It's been marvelous over these last few chapters to see how Judah has changed from a man who doesn't want to know God as he sold Joseph into slavery, to be a man who is desperate to honor God. In fact, who's leading according to God's plan as he goes back into Egypt. And it's entirely appropriate, therefore, that he should lead the people to their, what is, I say, a temporary rescue, but it's going to be a rescue that will last 400 years. But do you remember when Pharaoh told Joseph to bring his father and everybody back to him? Verse 17 of chapter 45, it says, Pharaoh said to Joseph, tell your brothers, do this, load your animals and return to the land of Canaan, and bring your father and your families back to me. I'll give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you can enjoy the fat of the land. And you're also directed to tell them, do this, take some carts from Egypt for your children and your wives, and get your father and come. Never mind about your belongings, because the best of all Egypt will be yours. And as they arrive, actually they bring with them their possessions. So they haven't done what Pharaoh has said. You see that detail? Verse 29, Joseph had his chariot made ready and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as Joseph appeared before him, he threw his arms around his father and he wept for a long time. And Israel said to Joseph, now I am ready to die, since I have seen for myself that you're still alive. What's going on?
Joseph had a dream. One day the whole family will bow down to me, so God says. And here they find everybody's bowing down to him.
And Israel had borne it in mind.
And somewhere in the back of his mind had been this unfulfilled point that God would keep. Some way, somehow, God would keep. God does not ever, ever fail to keep his promises. Now I've seen it kept, says Israel. I'm ready to die.
I've seen my family rescued from this terrible situation. I've seen God fulfill for us what he said he would fulfill. I'm ready at last, having seen this reprieve, I'm ready at last to go.
That has tremendous echoes within it, doesn't it? Tremendous echoes of another man who 1500 years later or so,
said of a little baby that was carried into a temple at Jerusalem, now I'm ready to die, because I've seen God's salvation, said Simeon as Jesus was presented at the temple. Now I see that God means what he says and does what he means.
And Jacob could say, I'm ready to die because I've seen a God who keeps his promises and more. We were told to leave our stuff behind. We brought it with us, and look at all that's before us.
Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I'll go up and I'll speak to Pharaoh and I'll say to him, my brothers and my father's household were living in the land of Canaan and have come to me. Why don't you let them settle here in Egypt and mingle about with the rest of the Egyptians? And why don't you let them become a part of our society and so on? No, he doesn't say that, because God, in keeping his promises, has something else in mind. Why does it say all shepherds are detestable to Egyptians? What a strange thing to have written down in the Bible. Here is a prejudice beyond comprehension. You don't expect the Bible to say stuff like that, do you? I mean, if it said something like gypsies are detestable, you'd say, ouch, you can't write non-politically correct things like that, but it does. Why? What is God doing?
Joseph said to his brothers and his father's household, I'll go up and I'll speak to Pharaoh. And I'll say to him, my brothers and my father's household were living in the land of Canaan and have come to me. The men were shepherds. Watch Pharaoh wince at this point. Yuck. You mean to say the prime minister of my land, the guy I've put as only a second under me, actually comes from shepherds? Yuck.
The men are shepherds. They tend livestock And they've brought along their flocks and herds and everything they own. And when Pharaoh calls you and asks you, what's your occupation? You're not to say, well, actually, I'm a shepherd, but I do a bit of tent making on the side. Because he'll grab that and you'll be pulled into the Egyptian community. And you're not to say, well, actually, I know how to cut down reeds and make papyrus. I know how. No, you're to say exactly what you've done. You're shepherds. Doesn't matter if he winces. You've tended livestock from your boyhood, just as our father did. Why? Well, because then you'll be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen, a distinct place away from all the other Egyptians. And you'll be able to establish there a community and a nation that God is blessing and has blessed and will bless. These people are to enjoy the best of the land, and all because of the Egyptians' hatred of shepherds. And they won't integrate, and some of them start to worship the god of the Egyptians, this Ra god, and all the rest of that we've been reading about. They'll enjoy the privilege of God keeping his promises, and more than keeping his promises. And as the 400 years develop, and the people of Israel see God blessing them as he promised Abraham he would, and as he promised Isaac he would, and as he's just promised Jacob he would, as they see God keeping and more than keeping his promises, they'll be able to see how God has led them and blessed them thus far. I don't know what you're facing in the course of this next week, in the next month, or the next few months. Some are facing great hopes of delight, and others exams, and others great uncertainty. But I can say, because this is the kind of God we have, that when you do what he says, not that life will be easy, there's no guarantee of that, but that when you do what he says, keeps his promises, and if you are a Christian, you can look forward fundamentally to that greatest promise that is the greatest security of life, that he will take you to heaven when you die. Only when we look back at our lives can we see the blessings of how he has led us.